available on digital media, iTunes podcast, smartphone apps, and from the online website. This is Outlook, the talking newspaper for Coventry.
Hello and welcome after our 2 week break. Welcome back to Outlook, this one being recorded on the 10th of April 2024. And coming up in the next programme, we're going to find out what's happened to cash with the prevalence of plastic money now. We're going to talk about The Great Escape. No, not the film of it, but a much earlier one, six centuries ago. And also we find out about the children's book, The Gruffalo. You'll remember that last programme we started the story of Churchill, his idiosyncratic ways and his emotions. Well, Bill's going to complete that story this week. And you'll also remember that last time we talked about the Coventry Motor Museum winning an award. Well, Dave's been back there to find out more about that. But of course that's the main part of the programme. Before that we've got sport, news from the centre and your postbag, but we're going to start as always with a review of the last fortnight's news with Elaine and Peter.
Outlook News.
Experts will be carrying out archaeological works ahead of the first phase of the £450 million regeneration project set to transform Coventry. Works will be taking place over the coming months as part of City Centre South. The works will ensure that the heritage of the site is recorded, understood and preserved prior to any buildings being constructed. House builders The Hill Group and Shearer Property Group said they will be looking to protect any historical findings. Archaeologists from Cotswold Archaeology have begun a survey of the site, with trenches taking place in various locations, starting in the barracks car park, before moving to the Bullyard and Shelton Square. Works are estimated to take 7 to 8 weeks and are likely to be completed by June. It will include the excavation of 23 trial trenches of varying sizes and depths, seeking to locate the line of the city wall, as well as identify any other archaeological remains. Items found during the works will be logged, protected and covered for further investigation until the site has been cleared. Andy Fancy, Managing Director at the Hill Group, said, "We are committed to carrying out the archaeological investigation works at City Centre South, both safely and sensitively, to protect any historical findings before the start of construction." Visiting the site as the dig began, Councillor Jim O'Boyle, Cabinet Member for Jobs, Regeneration and Climate Change at Coventry City Council, added, "I am pleased that this work is underway, along with the work to relocate shop mobility to a new location at Salt Lane Car Park." Councillor O'Boyle added, "Work to map and record information is important, and the house builders are very experienced, so I'm sure it will be done efficiently and carefully with the data used to help support future stages." The house builders are also working closely with Coventry City Council and West Midlands Police to ensure that emergency protocols are in place should the trenching unearth any unexploded ordnance that remains as a result of the city being bombed during the Second World War. Almost 1,000 homes have been given the green light in this first phase of Coventry City South, including 200 affordable homes, along with space for shops, businesses and a public open space. Construction is set to begin later this year, with the first homes expected to be built by 2027.
Doubts about whether the futuristic Coventry VLR tram system should be built have been backed by locals. Support for the project has reportedly not been shown by the government, and some Coventrians agree. It is reported that the government has rejected Coventry City Council's bid for tens of millions of pounds to pay for the new tram system. And this decision has been supported by locals who have said it is unwanted. In fact, some of them have likened it to the city's cycle lanes, which they claim were also unwanted and were an unneeded spend. One person said, "Abort the whole idea. Should have bitten the bullet and aborted the cycle routes too." Another added, "Well done to the government officials who refused funding for this unwanted scheme. Don't waste a single penny on this waste of time. School bus routes are being cancelled, and that's where taxpayers' money is much better spent. And don't spend money on cycle lanes. How many Coventry people actually cycle to work? In an ideal world, I'd love to walk to and from work, but I don't have the luxury of living that close." The project, however, is being championed by the City Council and supported by the West Midlands Combined Authority. Under the plans, the track would be built in two parts, with the first half ending at the old IKEA building. It will go from Warwick Road, near Coventry Rail Station, to Millennium Place, where the Coventry Transport Museum is located. It is no secret that the plan has not been plain sailing, with funding issues a key reason behind that. Documents seen by the BBC report that government civil servants have raised questions about whether VLR was good value for money, and they've also questioned whether Coventry was the right location for the scheme at all.
Major new highway projects between Solihull and Coventry have been revealed as HS2 continues to take shape. New bridges, a new roundabout and a dual carriageway are among the latest plans announced for the building of the high-speed rail link connecting to an interchange station near Birmingham Airport. While the northern leg of the line was scrapped, Phase 1 between London and Birmingham is expected to open between 2029 and 2033. A proposed new bridge would take Waste Lane, which connects Balsall with Coventry, over the HS2 line. Other bridges over the new line would carry Lavender Hall Lane, which connects Coventry, Berkswell and Balsall Common, and Diddington Lane, a road that runs between Hampton in Arden and Stonebridge. Changes are also proposed to the A452 Kenilworth Road between Stonebridge and Balsall Common. North of Bradnock's Marsh Lane, a realignment would see a new roundabout and dual carriageway taking the A452 over the line to the east of the road's existing layout. The proposals are set to be submitted for final approval in the next 3 months. Council officials said proposals had been developed after talks with the authorities' highways and planning teams over the past years. Officers are also recommending that the Cabinet agrees to a further report over the proposed layout for the A45 Stonebridge Junction, expected to be the final element of the HS2 major highway scheme.
An emergency department nurse from Coventry has been recognised for his work tackling the carbon footprint of the NHS. It's estimated that the NHS accounts for 4% of England's total carbon footprint. Ebenezer Okorie-Yeboah, a PhD researcher at Coventry University, was looking at cutting the waste of single-use plastics, at properly sorting waste, and at reducing power consumptions. The researcher's work earned him a commendation and involvement in an international conference from the Royal College of Nursing. The 27-year-old moved to the UK from Ghana just over 2 years ago after qualifying as a nurse in his home country. He has combined his work at hospitals in Coventry and Warwick with his PhD research at the University's Research Centre for Healthcare and Communities. His work included a global survey of nurses to understand how their work affected climate change, and this survey was completed by 500 people in 56 countries. Mr. Okorie-Yeboah said, "When people are displaced by situations created by climate change, it's health professionals who are the ones who have to look after them. And when we are doing that, we are in turn adding to the carbon footprint." He has recommended such things as sustainability training for nurses and greener NHS purchasing. Looking back on what he'd achieved since arriving in Britain, Mr. Okorie-Yeboah said, "It's been a beautiful journey. In Ghana, I read about the Royal College of Nurses in textbooks, and now I'm part of it and have won a national award."
A Coventry micro bakery is crowdfunding to set up shop in an empty high street building set for renovation. Lillian Fox hopes to raise £15,000 to invest in the old Penny Cook and Son premises in Earlston Street. The council approved plans last week to renovate the former jewellers with a new shopfront and a two-storey extension. Planning documents revealed the shop and adjoining flat would be brought back into viable use after an extended period of being vacant. The family-run bakery, which is currently home-based, said it was incredibly excited to be taking the next step. Writing on the bakery's website, founders Charlotte Lee and Daniel Perry revealed their plans. "We're incredibly excited and, of course, a bit scared to be taking this exciting new step," they wrote. They paid tribute to the incredible patience of the owner of the property for being so supportive in making this happen. But the post added the business needed help towards the £15,000 of an estimated £25,000 setup cost to buy equipment and get the shop ready. "Your positive and encouraging comments have helped us to get where we are, and your generosity will make a dream come true for us," the pair said. The business, which the couple started last year, is named after their children and Musley's grandmother, who was a baker in Coventry in the 1950s.
Prologis Park in Coventry is set to expand after planning permission has been approved. Prologis UK has been given permission to extend the Golden Triangle by building either a single unit or a two-unit scheme on the site, depending on customer demand. Located just 5 minutes from M6 Junction 3 and within 15 miles of five different motorways, Prologis Park, Coventry is set to be a highly sought-after location for businesses within the automotive and wider logistics sector. Once complete, the scheme at Coventry will bring the total value of assets under Prologis management in the Midlands to over £3 billion, and the business's Warwickshire holdings to over 3.4 million square feet, spread across Prologis Park Wrighton and Prologis Park Coventry. Maria Bailey, head of planning at Nuneaton and Bedworth Borough Council, said, "It's our foremost priority to support activity which will directly provide a net benefit to our region. The granting of this planning application means that there are more chances than ever for the local community to pursue roles within a stable and progressive industry. Supporting the growth of businesses and attracting more commercial activities to the area will secure the delivery of a valuable employment site and bring inward investment and jobs to our borough."
A historic Coventry venue has been recognised for making heritage more accessible at a ceremony celebrating the region's tourist industry. St Mary's Guildhall, operated by No Ordinary Hospitality, has been awarded silver in the Accessible and Inclusive Tourism category at the West Midlands Tourism Awards 2024, held at the NEC in Birmingham. The achievement follows the 14th century's venue's £6 million restoration programme, which saw the levelling of the courtyard floor, the installation of new lifts, improved access and a hearing loop throughout the building. The accolade also recognises its work in improving visitors' access to the building's history through its community and education programmes. The venue picked up the gold prize in the same category at last year's awards. Niamh Carter, Community Engagement Manager at St Mary's Guildhall, said, "We're so proud to have been recognised for a second year running. Access and inclusion are the cornerstone of what we do here at St Mary's Guildhall. We want to make certain that this amazing historical space is open to everyone, and we are constantly working to improve on what we do here. From the physical access features such as lifts, to our sensory-friendly time slots and sensory bags, to our community work. Everything we do is designed to celebrate the diversity of Coventry's communities and to welcome everyone in. As part of its National Lottery-funded Community Engagement Programme, the historic attraction offers a range of talks, exhibitions and workshops designed to keep the Guildhall at the heart of the community. It has delivered co-curated exhibitions for South Asian Heritage and Black History Months, working alongside local artists and community groups.
voters across Coventry and Warwickshire will head to the polls on local election day, the 2nd of May. These elections are among dozens taking place across England and Wales. They are a test of party support ahead of a general election, which is expected to be held later this year. Councillors will be elected in three local authority areas, Coventry, Nuneaton and Bedworth, and Rugby. In Coventry, one third of the seats, 18 of 54, are up for election on the Labour-controlled City Council. Coventry City Council is a metropolitan district and is responsible for most of the services in its area. It runs a range of services such as social care, education and school transport for eligible pupils. Voters will pick councillors in all 38 seats on the Conservative run, Nuneaton and Bedworth Borough Council. There will be elections in one third of the seats, 14 of 42, on Rugby Borough Council, which is led by a Conservative minority administration. Borough councils, such as those in Rugby and Nuneaton and Bedworth, are parts of a larger local authority covering the entire county of Warwickshire. These borough councils provide local services such as rubbish collection, housing and dealing with planning applications. There will also be a vote to elect the Police and Crime Commissioner, the PCC, for the County of Warwickshire. PCCs represent political parties and are elected to oversee their local police forces. The role includes setting the police force's budget and appointing its chief constable. And voters in much of the West Midlands, including those in Coventry, will also be electing the region's mayor and the region's PCC. About 1.2 million people live in the areas where elections are taking place in Coventry and Warwickshire. You need to sign up to the electoral register before midnight on April the 16th to be eligible to vote and have ID in order to cast your vote. Those who have registered will be able to vote in the areas where ballots are being held. To vote in person at a polling station, you either need to show one of the 22 acceptable forms of ID or have a free document known as a voter authority certificate, which you can apply for before Wednesday the 24th of April. The results of the elections to the councils in Coventry, Nuneaton and Bedworth and Rugby will be declared at some point on Friday the 3rd of May, while the results of the Warwickshire PCC election is expected to be declared on Saturday the 4th of May.
A Coventry mum said she was taken aback by some of the prices being charged at Coombe Abbey Park. She described the prices of ice cream cones as extortionate. Coombe Abbey Park has been a popular visitor spot for many years and has even been awarded the TripAdvisor Traveller's Choice Award. In May 2018, No Ordinary Hospitality Management was appointed to take over the on-site catering by Coventry City Council. Emma McCafferty visited Coombe Abbey Park on Tuesday, April the 2nd. Her young son asked for an ice cream, but Emma was shocked to learn the cost. Photos show that a single cone with no flake starts at £3.95, while a double cone with flake costs £5.70. Emma said, "I just went for an afternoon at Coombe Abbey Park. I went with my son, and he could see other children had ice cream, so he wanted one. We were in the queue, and once you are in the queue, you are committed to buying one. Then you get to the point where you see the prices on the wall, and it was just really extortionate prices." Emma reluctantly forked out £7.90 so as not to upset her young son, saying, "I was taken aback by how much they were actually charging for an ice cream, and I only have one child. But say if you had two or three children, it is quite a hefty price for a treat." Emma said she visited Skegness last weekend and was able to buy three ice creams for just £7.50. "I was really shocked to see those prices at Coombe Abbey. People are saying support local businesses and trying to get people to spend money within Coventry, but they do not have to charge that much. They would still make a profit. I think people need advance warning." If I had had advance warning, I would not have brought one or even got in the queue. I would have made some excuse not to buy one. So just a warning to other people, either take a lot of extra cash with you or avoid it. A spokesman for the No Ordinary Hospitality Management said, items from the kiosk start at £2.50 and all prices are clearly displayed on the board. We work as hard as we possibly can to offer refreshments and treats to suit all budgets, but we have had to increase the prices of these particular ice creams due to a 26% rise in the cost of ingredients and a 10% rise in staffing costs. We are in regular contact with our suppliers, and our ice cream prices are in line with other outlets which have fixed costs.
Residents at a care home have been knitting blankets to help guide dog puppies adjust to their new homes. The group at the Royal Leamington Spa Nursing Home take part in a knitting club twice a week, which is run by carer Elaine Isles. After receiving a visit from Abby, a guide dog pup, the volunteers decided to turn their creations into a comfort for the next generation of guide dogs. Miss Isles said, "They love it. It gives them something to do. We reminisce about childhood games that we played. It's great fun." At 6 weeks old, the pups leave their breeding centres to live with a puppy raiser armed with a puppy pack, which contains a blanket with their mother's scent. It is thought these blankets help to ease their transitions into their new lives. Jill, a puppy raiser for the Guide Dogs charity, looks after Abby. She said, "For the first few days, it really helps the puppies settle, as they're in a strange environment on their own, sleeping at night instead of with a nice, warm, cuddly litter. It's where they struggle and have the most anxiety. But now, because they have the scent on the blanket, it makes them much calmer."
Coventry City Football Club's charity is appealing for money so its therapy dog Winnie can visit 100 care homes, schools and hospitals. The initiative, named Paws for a Cause, was set up by the Sky Blues in the community to provide emotional and social support for vulnerable people. Donations will also support the charity's dementia project that provides regular physical activity for those with a diagnosis. Winnie, who is described as a quiet and sensitive dog, has visited more than 10 care homes so far in Coventry and Warwickshire. The charity aims to raise £2,500 to fund Winnie's visits, along with other projects like walking and blind football sessions. It's a really rewarding thing to do, and it's really touching to see people with Winnie, said her owner Johnny Sindler. It's been amazing, and people can get quite emotional when they see Winnie. Mr. Sindler is also the charity's health and wellbeing manager, and was inspired to start the initiative after he saw dogs being used in Birmingham Children's Hospital. To watch how much a dog lifted the moods of young children who were going through very traumatic experiences made me realise how beneficial animal therapy can be, he said. Since the football charity started the project, Mr. Zindler said the response for Winnie to visit care homes had been crazy. Winnie wears her sky blues coat when she visits residents, and her journey across the county has been documented on Instagram, filled with updates and pictures of her visitors. Children at schools also get to meet Winnie after the charity delivers mental health presentations. Donations to fund the initiative can be received through the charity's GoFundMe page.
Outlook News.
Now I've got myself back off the floor of a £3.95 cone, thanks to Elaine and to John for the roundup of the news. The only announcement I've got is sunrise is now 6:17, and sunset is 7:57 now.
Hello, it's Sarah here, not with sport, but I thought it might be very useful for any listener who will be going to UHCW or Walsgrave Hospital as I still call it, over the next few weeks. At the moment they are replacing the front revolving doors, or revolting doors as I prefer to call them. And it is, well, it's doable, but it is quite difficult if you have a visual impairment, or I found it difficult on my own anyway. So, when you approach the front of the hospital, as if you're going towards where the doors used to be, you are sent on quite a long detour to the left, which apparently brings you out somewhere in the corridor that normally will take you down and into the outpatients department. To exit the hospital, you have to go down the opposite wing, that is, to the right as you're outside of the hospital. You go down apparently to roughly by Ward 2, and the exit is there. It brings you out at the side of the Wisdom Centre, where people may go for diabetes or for physio. So if you are then going to get a taxi, the taxis are pretty much straight ahead of you. But if, like me, you're going to get a bus, you need to wend your way round to the right. Now, when I got home, I did phone the hospital to ask to speak to the access officer, but they don't seem to have one. And I eventually got put through to the security controller, who said it will be going on for the next few weeks, but she couldn't be more precise than that. Though I'm sure I saw a notice that said June, but don't quote me on that. And the best thing is, there are the security guys have apparently got high-vis jackets on. So if you can see anybody in a high-vis jacket and you need a bit of help, just ask. I was very lucky because I found a volunteer when I got actually into the hospital who took me to where I needed to go. But as you may imagine, the reception area, the atrium, is absolute organised chaos at the moment, with people walking around looking very lost. But the great thing is, the most important part of the hospital is still there. And by that I mean the M&S food hall, of course. Anyway, just thought I would pass that on. Bye!
Right, thank you, Sarah. Yes, we used some information there on University Hospital. Now we're moving on to the regular Hugh. Hello, Hugh.
Prune juice, that's the answer, I think, isn't it? Yeah. Thank you very much, Nigel. Hello, everybody. I hope you had a lovely Easter. And what I'm going to talk to you first about is an event that we held last Saturday at the Criterion Theatre. I mentioned this in the last edition. So the Creative Writing Group has launched an audiobook version of Who Turned Out the Lights, which we did at the Criterion the other night. It was a glittering affair, I'd like to say. We had the Deputy Lord Mayor, Mal Mutton, come along. We had invited the Lord Mayor, but he's in India, so the Deputy Lord Mayor came along, and she was great, very good indeed. And we also had Vic Minette, her off of the radio. She is a great supporter of the charity, as many of you know. I get dragooned onto the show quite a lot, but to talk about the charity and other things. But she was a fantastic supporter of the charity. What she did on Monday was to have Jess Eastman, who runs the Creative Writing Group, and Derek Headley, who is a member of the Creative Writing Group, in on her show. And if you want to listen to that, then you can navigate. If you can navigate BBC Sounds, get to last Monday morning, and I think it's about 11:30 in the morning. Might be a bit there. The day before yesterday. Yes, as we're speaking, there's a good old section on the on the book. So the book itself was recorded by an organisation called Media Mania, who work to help young people get into the creative arts and to learn how to do things like make big recordings and things. And the actors from the Criterion Theatre were the people who read the actual poem. So this was John Elves, Helen McGowan and Anne Houston, all of whom I can say are terrific actors. I've worked with all of them and absolutely just wonderful. So what they've produced is something very, very high quality, and it brings a new life to the writing. Now, you'll know that we actually published this book a few years ago, the first amount of writing that they did. So this is what's been turned into the audio book. We are really proud of the collaboration that we have had with the Criterion and now Media Mania. The Creative Writing Group has not stopped writing, of course, so they've got an awful lot of stuff, an awful lot of material, and I'm very pleased to say that there are going to be future printed editions and future audio editions of their work coming out, and we're going to really disseminate this around the country as well if we can. So certainly through the Visionary Network, and Visionary is the umbrella organisation for charities like ours, you know, we hope to get their work out to other local charities around the country, and you know, we're going to try and get them into the audio libraries as well, perhaps at RNIB. But if you want your own copies, you can. So there are three formats that you can have. You can have a USB. Now, you're listening quite possibly to this program on a USB stick. Exactly the same thing. Pop it in your media player that you're listening on now, and you'll get the whole book. And also a CD version is available as well, and those are both £5, and you can get those from here. There will be other places that you can get them in the long term, but we're just working out a few deals. There's a few bookshops who are really interested in stocking those for us, but for the moment you can get the hard copy versions, as it were, from here. But this being the modern world, you can also download a copy. And this is from an organisation called Bandcamp. Now, I could give you the very, very long email address, not email address, website address of how to get to Bandcamp and the book on there. But the much easier way is to go onto our very own website, and if you put in www.coventryblind.org.uk, that will take you to the front page of our website, and at the bottom of there, there's a very big panel, and you can just press on something in there and it'll take you straight to the place where you can download the book. Or if you're happier just carrying on typing on that address bar, you can just put in www.coventryblind.org.uk/books, and that will immediately take you to the other thing without any further clicking. There's a slight discount on the downloaded version, £4. I say discount. I mean, that's a £4. It's a minimum charge. You know, you can pay £4, or you could pay more. We don't mind.
Yeah.
We're very liberal in these sorts of things. So if you would like to get a copy of that, then those are the three ways you can do that. The hard copy versions, you can just come into when you're next in the resource centre, get those. So that would be great. So it was a really good, great affair on Saturday night. So we talked about how the Creative Writing Group got started and how they work and what they do and what the collaboration with the theatre has been like. And, you know, we talk not only about the audiobook but also about the theatre trips that we do down there and you know, the great amount of traffic that we've had, you know, in terms of volunteers, because quite a number of our volunteers here, you know, got to know us because they were also members of the theatre, and they've proven to be a great source of support for us. I also sat down and did an interview myself with Derek about how he writes and how he does his process. It was I felt like Michael Parkinson a bit, actually. It was good, you know. So an excellent event, and so you can listen to the fruits of that on the USBs or the CDs or downloading. Right. Next things next. The satellite group for the monthly satellite group for Canley, so that's the CV4 VIPs, next takes place next Wednesday, the 17th of April, and that is in the afternoon. I think it's 2 o'clock in the afternoon. Now, if you would like to go to that, please do. I mean, it's sort of aimed at people in the Canley area, Tar Hill, Eastern Green, if you can get there. It all takes place at the Canley Community Centre. Kudi will be there, and she'll be talking about daily living aids and various other things. If you're one of the people out in the great wide land of Coventry who doesn't really come into the centre very much, but you wouldn't mind a little bit of contact with us, you know, this is a really great opportunity. If you've got some little issues or problems that you need solving, then you can come to that group. Kudu will make a note of it, and then we can deal with it and help you out. So definitely worth going. So that's next Wednesday, the 17th of April, at the Canley Community Centre.
Do the people who go to there, can they bring friends along who have sight problems as well, who aren't probably aware of what we're doing here?
Absolutely. Yes. It's absolutely designed for that purpose. Yes. Open to anybody who's struggling, you know, with any aspect of sight loss. Yes. They don't have to be, you know, registered or registrable, blind or partially sighted. That doesn't matter. If you're struggling a bit, or if you know that you've got dry macular degeneration, for example, and you've been discharged from the hospital, but you're beginning to struggle a bit, then, you know, absolutely come along. That is, you know, precisely the point of it. We want to reach as many people as possible. Now, it was mentioned on the news here a few weeks ago about the green bins and the new charge that that Coventry City Council are making for collection of green bins. Now, I had a phone call this morning from Carol Bloxham, who was concerned about how this was going to work for visually impaired people, and particularly for people who, who have their bins. They've got assisted bin collections as well, and whether there was any concessions for people with disabilities, etc., etc. I have to tell you now, there are no concessions for people with disabilities. However, if you have an assisted bin collection, then they will still assist you in collecting your green bin. You still need to have the sticker. You still got to get the sticker. Now, one of Carol's concerns was that she'd been told that it was available online only. No. I'm very pleased to say that it is not available just online only. There's a telephone number that you can call, and that telephone number is 0808 58 34 333. I'll give you that again, 0808 58 34 333. Or in fact, you can go into to the customer service centre in the upper precinct if you happen to be in town and pay in person. So if you're doing it over the phone, you will need to be able to recite your card number and that sort of thing. I don't think they've just put it on the bill. So, I mean, in terms of accessibility, not brilliant. If you come into the centre regularly and you want us to help you with that, we'll absolutely help you with that. Of course we will. So that's the answer to that question. You still get assisted collections for that, but you do need the sticker. You can call them, but you do to sign up, but you will have to pay over the phone as well.
£50 a year, isn't it?
Like, I think it's 40 quid a year. And apparently last year they were handing out free green bins. So somebody was telling me, they were saying, yes, you can have another green bin if you want it. And it's like, now we know why.
Yes.
Anyway, so, and I think, dear friends, that is it for this week.
Thank you very much. Thanks, you.
Thank you.
See you next one. Most sportsmen and women take little heed of the weather, except, of course, maybe golfers with courses due to the excessive rain. So Sarah's here with a roundup of 2 weeks of sport.
Well, hello there, listeners, and welcome to your sport. I hope you all had a wonderful Easter and didn't eat too many chocolate eggs, although what the heck, it's only once a year. Now, I'm going to start off slightly differently this week because I'm going to start off with rugby union. I'm doing it in date order. And on Friday night, Coventry entertained Cambridge at the Butts Park Arena. Well, Cambridge, your university may have won the men's and women's boat race, but my gosh, did we send you packing with your tail between your legs. Coventry ran out winners 64 points to 12. That promotions place is looking really in touch. Just think, wouldn't that be wonderful? All of our local teams going up. Well, it's good to dream. Anyway, on Friday, and going back to football now, the Lionesses played their first match in the European qualifier. You may recall that they are holders of the European Championship, having beaten Germany last time at Wembley in that infamous final. Well, this time they took on Sweden, and it wasn't the most inspiring of matches, to be honest. I didn't watch all of it. I watched Coronation Street in the middle of it. But they came out with the draw, one goal each. And so now to Saturday. On the back of a defeat to Cardiff City, Coventry City took on Leeds United this weekend. And there was a lot of trepidation going into that match. I mean, Leeds were only relegated from the Premiership last year and have been one of the clubs vying for the top position and automatic promotion back to the Premiership this year. Well, we needn't have worried, because goals from both Ellis Sims and Hadji Wright put us 2-0 up. But then, of course, City being City, we had to let Leeds back into it, which made for a very nervous finish. But we were the winners, 2-1. So the promotions is still on, or the promotion playoff. We're currently in 7th place, as I'm recording on the Tuesday. Although I know we're away to Southampton tonight, who are also one of the promotion playoff teams. Unfortunately, it was not so good, much good news for our local football sides in the Southern League Central Premier Division, or words to that effect. Both Leamington and Stratford lost 1-0. Stratford lost at home to Redditch, and Leamington lost away to Telford. But the great news is, they are both still in the promotion zone as well. Looking good, as I say, for local teams. Just think of all those open top bus tours. We could clog a street. And can I just give a huge mention to Solihull Moors, who are just up the road from us. They have made it to the final at Wembley of the FA Vars. It is the first time they have ever gone to Wembley. They've beaten Bromley on aggregate 2-1 with a 1-0 win on Saturday. So well done, Solihull. Oh, it's now the time to love your local sport. Honest. Staying with local sport, you may recall our local runner, well, he runs for Comtry Godiva Harriers, Adam Fogg, was selected recently for the British team for an indoor championship. Well, this time he was selected for the World Cross-Country Championship. And he wasn't just selected, but he was pretty much responsible for us getting the bronze medal. He took over his leg. He was running third of the four legs in the relay. And he took over in 8th place quite near the back, but by the end of his lap he was perfectly poised to hand over to the fourth runner in fourth place, which is the ideal place because you can see the guy you've got to beat just in front of you and he's yours for the pipping on the line. So, well done, Adam, and I hope you make it to the Olympics. And I'll say it now, there are only 107 more days to go to the Olympics. Oh, I am getting very excited. Now, there's actually not a lot of national sport for me to report on. I mean, looking at the three I cover a lot, or sport covers quite a lot. In tennis, Rafa Nadal has withdrawn from yet another championship, the Monte Carlo, which is seen as the warm-up event to the French Open. And also, I heard yesterday that both Cameron Norrie and Dan Evans lost in the first round of yet another Open tournament. Meanwhile, in F1, Max Verstappen won yet again, this time in Japan. And although it's really early on in the season, it's already thought that nobody else can possibly catch him. And in the golf, Rory McIlroy and Tommy Fleetwood did rather well at the Texas Open, but neither of them won. But of course, tennis and golf are both in the Olympics. Ooh. And finally, now in the absence of a lot of sport to talk about, I'm going to talk about the weather. No, I haven't lost the plot. The weather and its impact on sport. Three sports in particular have been highlighted within the last week or two on the television sports news. And so I'm going to talk about them, if that's okay with listeners, because we're in the build-up to the Olympics. Anyway, starting off with football. Now, the Premier and Championship clubs seem to live in oasis of dryness, and for some reason many of them have the sprinklers out just before the match. But I'm talking really about the lower league and particularly the non-league clubs. Now, my little non-league Coventry United are very fortunate with their home matches because they play on an artificial surface at Butts Park Arena. But the FA, Football Association, has determined that the season must finish for non-league clubs on April the 20th. And there is one team somewhere in the north of England, I didn't catch where, who has got 9 matches still left to play because of postponements, because of dreadfully boggy pitches. And apparently the guys worked out that the team will literally be playing Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday they have off, Saturday they play, and Sunday they have off. And these guys are only they're not professionals at all. They are proper amateurs who have jobs. Oh, well. Now, I feel also very sorry for the Scottish, in particular, golf clubs. I think we all know that many of our local clubs have been closed or had diversions on the courses because of flooding in the sort of lower-lying areas. But many of the Scottish coastal courses are facing quite severe erosion. Featured in particular on the news was one club up in Inverness, which ALEXA informs me is 480 miles away in northeast Scotland. But they are used to losing 1 metre through coastal erosion per year. But because of the dreadfully high seas, because of the rain and also the rough weather, they lost 6 metres of one of their fairways in 1 week. Come on, guys. Please do something for climate change. The other sport that has been featured locally in particular is horse racing. You might think, well, what's horse racing affected by the weather? They go out in all weathers. Yes, but in their home stables, they have all weather tracks, but not the race courses. And most recently, race meetings at both Warwick and Stratford were cancelled. In fact, the director of one of the courses, I think it was Warwick that I heard interviewed on CWR, said the problem is that the rain has just washed away so much of the infrastructure of the soil that it would just be like a horse galloping on rice pudding. Not a happy thought. But, ironically, the cricket season started on Friday and there was some play in the Warwickshire v Worcestershire match, which fortunately was at Edgbaston and not at the boating lake that becomes the Worcestershire home ground. Don't get wet this week, folks. Lol. Anyway, that's all from me. See you next week. Bye.
Plenty of sport there for the keen sportsmen and women among our listeners, though I know some of you aren't so enthusiastic. Now, let's hear from Dave what messages have fallen into his postbag over Easter.
This is Postbag. Join in the discussion.
Hello and welcome to your postbag. Now, I'm recording this, first of all, in sunny Llandudno. In fact, I'm looking out of the hotel window and I can see the pier and the Great Orme and the waves crash rolling in. Okay, so anyway, so I hope you've had a nice Easter. Now, John has written an article because Julia was away on Good Friday. So here's an article by John, following by with a request. It says, everybody needs good friends. I'm filling in for my friend Julia. She normally comes round on a Friday to practice her typing and spelling. But today, being Good Friday, she seems to have decided she's a Christian, so is unable to travel. I don't understand my friend Julia. I just know she moves in mysterious ways. I wonder where she gets that from. Anyway, I know that my other friend David looks forward to Julia's reports. That's why I'm attempting to fill in for my friend Julia. But how can one person fill in for another? We're different people, aren't we? I shouldn't attempt to be philosophical. It hurts my brain. I know who I can write about. My friends Jill and Mike Lane. They are both very good friends of the Resource Centre. Mike is the unofficial photographer. Whenever there is an event at the centre, Mike can be seen with a posh camera taking pictures. Jill is even more involved. She started off the computer workshops before the millennial. There were only 4 computers in those days. Jill has also run several cooking classes at the centre. Both have been very closely involved in many ways. But now they're going through a bad patch. Mike has been very ill and is currently undergoing dialysis in a Belgreen nursing home. Jill is having to catch 2 buses there and back every day to visit him. She is under a great strain. She would dearly love to find a nursing home nearer to Earlston. Eventually, she would like to have Mike at home, but she needs a hospital bed in order to manage this. Mike and Jill have been such good friends to the Resource Centre over the years. Can anybody help them? My friend Julia will be back next week. Until then, lots of love Julia's friend John. So if you know of a good nursing home in Earlston, please let Mike and Jill know via John, via postbag. Okay, thank you very much. And now Graham Wales got something to talk about those lightweight trams that they're planning to put on Coventry streets.
I have mixed feelings about the lightweight rapid transport system proposed for Coventry. I have a problem with fixed track public transport systems. They might be okay for a place like Birmingham where there are large numbers of people to be moved around. But the problem with them is that if there's a breakdown or anything goes wrong on the track, then the whole thing comes to a halt. Whereas a bus, it can negotiate its way around obstacles. If they could only make the image of bus travel a little better than it is. The point was made in the news item that it's going to be drivers. It's not going to be driverless, so what is the advantage of it? Well, I believe the long-term plan for the lightweight rapid transport system is that it will be driverless eventually. That being the case, I will not be travelling on it.
Right, thank you, Graham. So what do you think about lightweight trams appearing on Coventry streets? And how about driverless trams? But that's something for the future. So that's of some concern. Yes. Okay, let us know your feelings about them. Now, here is an article from Julia. And it says, all my Easter friends. I gave my friend John the week off this Easter. That was because all my other friends were coming to visit me and I didn't have room in my diary for him. First, my friend Jen came around to do the hoovering. Then my sister Donna picked me up and went for a walk after lunch. But I'm not telling you what we had to eat because it's a secret. After that, it was my brother-in-law's turn, and risotto was on the menu with tuna and spice. But on Sunday, we had a roast with chicken, and they made me walk a mile around the block to lose the calories. But afterwards, I was rewarded with a little bit of chocolate cheesecake. Then we all went to see my other sister, my very lovely Denise. Later, we went out with Jen and my friend Elaine, and we all went to the Brooklands to get drunk and get arrested. So that was my Easter. It was good to get away from my friend John for a week. I also want to say how much I appreciate good old Sarah Lewis. I love her voice on Sports Report, and she's always very nice to me. And when she guides me into the Mary Beale room for Monday Club. Thank you, Sarah. It's spring, everybody. Yippee! Julia. Well, thank you, Julia. And now we have a tip from Edwina, who is deafblind, about the best way to talk to somebody who is deaf. Here's Edwina.
Hi, everybody. It's Edwina. I have given some thought to deafness, because I do like to give some sort of tip that will help somebody. Now, this one has been one that I've many times mentioned to guides. When you take someone for a cup of coffee in a cafe or even in a restaurant, very often it's very, very loud music. It is a good idea to find a quieter spot over in a corner so that they can hear better, because there is the hearing aid picking up the background noise and it blocks out what you want to hear so much. The other point is that very often, they just, well, it's family as well, just take a deaf person and sit them in the sunshine near the window. It should be the opposite. The guy that's with them should be sitting facing the window and the deafened person sitting with their back to the window. The reason why? Because some of them have still got useful sight and use lip reading. So because the sun is on that face, they still manage to lip read. Just think about it. It's something you could get used to, and it's very, very helpful. Take care, everybody. Bye.
Thank you for that, Edwina. Let's have your thoughts on the subject of communicating with someone who is deaf, or to have people communicating with you if you're hard of hearing. What's the best way to do it? Well, as the sun's going down in Llandudno, and I can see through our hotel window the lights on Llandudno Pier, I say thank you for your comments this week. Please let's hear from you next time. Bye for now.
This is Outlook. You can contact Postbag.
Our website is www.talkingnewspaper.org.uk. Our email address is postbag@talkingnewspaper.org.uk. Join in the discussion on Postbag.
And that's your Easter Postbag with Dave. Now, Charles has been a king for about a year or so, and we're starting to see money featuring his head, but is cash itself still king? Plastic money seems to be becoming increasingly prevalent, and to find out more, Elaine came across this article in the Daily Express, written by Russell Hyam.
Among the highlights of the Future of Money exhibition, which opens on February the 28th at the Bank of England Museum in London, are the King Charles Polymer banknotes in £5, £10, £20 and £50 denominations before their release on June the 5th. The wide-ranging showcase reflects the transformation of money over many centuries, from a Roman gold bar to a tally stick from 1824, recording money owed, through to contactless payment innovations, including wearable devices, as well as digital currency, such as Bitcoin. Yet it also raises the question, how long is there left for cash? There was a time, not so long ago, when you'd be given short shrift for trying to pay for anything less than a fiver with a credit card. These days, you might be refused service if you don't use one. Cash in many shops, cafes, restaurants and businesses up and down the country has become distinctly persona non grata. It is not illegal to refuse cash, but the government line is that businesses are able to choose the form of payment they accept. Two public petitions which recently tried to make it unlawful for retailers, except internet-based firms, to refuse cash payments were unsuccessful, despite collecting nearly 60,000 signatures. After being discussed by MPs in the House of Commons last March, the government responded by saying it does not plan to mandate cash acceptance. That might be fine for young, well-off and digitally savvy consumers who rarely leave home without their credit debit card or their mobile phone loaded with the right electronic wallet app. But what of the older, lower income or less technologically minded members of society, or indeed the 1.1 million Britons without a bank account? For now at least, we still have our paper money. In fact, the King is only the second reigning British monarch to appear on a banknote since the Bank of England started producing them in 1694. Happily, notes with the Queen on them will remain legal tender and will co-circulate alongside the King Charles notes. Originally handwritten, banknotes were issued as receipts for loans made to the government, which was raising money for a war against France. They are now made in a highly secure factory at Debden in Essex, in a process that takes up to 6 weeks. The exhibition reveals that whilst the use of cash in Britain has gone down since COVID to about 1 in 6 transactions, the amount of banknotes in circulation has, paradoxically, increased by almost 15% to around 81 billion. One reason for this could be because, in times of emergency or panic, when there is fear of a breakdown in the electronic banking system, people prefer to hold tangible assets which they can see and touch. That could be why, stashed away in vaults under the museum's floor, there is 250 billion in gold bullion, most of which the Bank of England holds on behalf of wealthy clients and foreign governments. Martin Mateig, National Chair of the Federation of Small Businesses, encourages the acceptance and use of cash by his members. Cash is vital as a competitor to other forms of payment, and as a payment option when digital systems go down or in areas with poor reception. Many vulnerable groups, from elderly people to those fleeing domestic violence, rely on being able to use cash, and it is also a key payment method for many visitors to the UK. The use of cash has been decreasing steadily since before the global pandemic, according to Link, the UK's cash access and ATM network. Link head of strategy Graham Mott told the Daily Express, "The high point for cash withdrawals was 2017, when 130 billion was dispensed through cash machines. That compares with 81 billion last year. So even though cash use has been in decline for several years, it still represents a significant amount of money. Our research shows that 70% of people in the UK have used cash in the last 2 weeks. Graham says it is not just Britain, but every country that is on a journey towards using less cash. Sweden is the leader, with only about 6% of transactions being made in cash. But the UK is following close behind. So could cash ever be phased out altogether? Indeed, the UK is currently considering introducing its own government-backed digital pound, which is not intended to replace cash, but might mean the demise of volatile, unregulated cryptocurrencies such as Bitcoin. Jennifer Adam, curator at the Bank of England Museum, doesn't think so. She believes that the new, more durable polymer banknotes, the average expected lifespan for the new £20 note is in excess of 20 years, are a sure sign of our commitment to keeping cash as part of the economy for the foreseeable future. Recent legislation supports her optimism. Last year, building on powers granted to the Financial Conduct Authority through the Financial Services and Markets Act, the government set out minimum standards for access to cash, especially for those in rural areas, the elderly, and those living with disabilities. These include protecting cash access without any fees for those who hold personal current accounts, as well as aiming to ensure that nobody in the country is further than 3 miles away from cash deposit and withdrawal facilities. That should be welcome news to Caroline Abrahams, charity director at Age UK, who says, "Many older people view cash as the most reliable and straightforward way to pay for goods and services, as well as an effective means of managing their weekly budget when money is extremely tight. For others, having notes and coins in their purse or wallet helps them to stay independent and retain firm control of their finances. Luckily, visitors to the new Future of Money exhibition will need to carry neither cash, credit card nor mobile phone. Entry to the Bank of England Museum, just off Threadneedle Street, is completely free of charge.
There's still plenty of cash around, but we've been using it less and less. Now, if I said to you The Great Escape, I guess your first thought would be that memorable film of the escape of prisoners from a German prisoner of war camp. But there was another great escape 6 centuries earlier, when a nobleman imprisoned by Edward II in the Tower of London made his own courageous bid to scale its walls. This lesser-known story was written by Anne O'Brien, and this first part is read by Bill.
The mass escape of Allied airmen from a German prisoner of war camp remains one of history's most famous jailbreaks. Stalag Luft III was designed to be escape-proof. The prisoner of war, using impressive ingenuity to remain undetected, dug a tunnel and crawled their way to safety, 30 feet below the oblivious guards. It was an amazing masterstroke, courage and endurance, nearly 80 years ago, in March 1944. Unfortunately, the tunnel stopped far short of the protective cover of the surrounding forest. Emerging one by one, men had to make a dash for it. This foiled the original plan to free the full 200 men. Even so, Nazis discovered that 76 hardy prisoners had broken out of their supposed fortress. Their heroic act was immortalised on screen 2 decades later in the 1963 film Great Escape, starring Steve McQueen, Richard Attenborough and James Garner. Yet it was not unprecedented. Prisoners throughout history, of men and women, driven by an obvious desire for freedom, plotted to escape from their confinement. 700 years ago, in 1323, was another great escape. This one from the massive fortress of the Tower of London. The story of Roger Mortimer, Earl of March, is no different, in its way, from that of the famous Allied prisoner of war. Mortimer was not the first person to escape from one of the most fearsome jails in the land, nor was he the last. Since it was built in the 11th century, there have been perhaps 40 successful breakouts from the Tower of London. 2 Jesuit prisoners, using a rope stretching across the moat, in spite of their hands being crippled by torture. And 1 Jacobite gentleman was aided and abetted into cross-dressing as a female visitor to fool the guards. Not all who risked the dangers lived to tell the tale. In 1244, Welsh rebel fell to his death from the White Tower, as the central keep is known. In the 17th century, Colonel Thomas Blood broke into the tower to steal the crown jewels, only to be captured before he could flee. Mortimer's escape on August 1, 1323, was a conspicuous success. A dramatic tale of secret letters, drug use, rope ladders, not least scaling 2 supposedly impregnable outer tower walls. But who was he, and why had he been locked up in the tower? Mortimer was the owner of vast estates in the Welsh Marches and in Ireland. At the beginning of the reign of King Edward II, he had been a loyal subject. That was until the royal favourite, Hugh de Spencer, backed by the king, laid claim to lands in the Welsh Marches. This would be a threat to the Mortimer influence, so he joined in a rebellion, raised his banners against the favourite and against the king. Edward II considered this to be treason, but Mortimer was arrested and carted off to the tower. When news was brought to him that his life was in danger, Mortimer planned his escape. He had been writing letters, smuggled out of the tower, to rouse another rebellion across England. Some were intercepted and delivered to the king. There was no better way for Edward II to solve the problem than to have the letter-writing plotter killed, hanged, drawn and quartered, as a lesson to all other would-be traitors. Better Mortimer was dead than alive to plot. For Mortimer, better that he risk a spectacular escape. In effect, escape or die. The event was cleverly planned for the night of the feast of St. Peter at Vincula. St. Peter was the patron saint of the church in the tower, and every year a feast was held, but the tower garrison would be celebrating with food and alcohol. Unlike the brave escapees from Stalag Luft, Mortimer had the promise of help from friends and collaborators, both inside and outside the tower. During the feast, guards, including the constable of the tower, all indulged liberally in wine and ale, and were drugged and put to sleep by an accomplice. With the guards comatose, Mortimer was free to escape.
And Bill will be back next week to complete that story of Richard Mortimer's escape to freedom and what it meant. Children of all ages will be familiar with The Gruffalo, written by Julia Donaldson. Here, Sue recounts the discussion between Julia and Simon Brand about the story behind her most famous book.
If you have young children, you probably have complicated feelings about Julia Donaldson's brilliant and beloved children's book, The Gruffalo. On the one hand, it's your kids' favourite bedtime story and they ask you to read it to them all the time. On the other, it's your kids' favourite bedtime story and they ask you to read it to them all the time. I do like it when parents say, "We enjoy reading your books aloud," says Donaldson, "because as a parent, I know how awful it is when your child wants some book read to them again and again that you can't stand." She smiles. "I do sometimes tell parents that they're allowed to drop my books down the back of the radiator." There's no getting rid of The Gruffalo, though. Released 25 years ago, the book tells the story of a plucky brown mouse who manages to convince three hungry predators, a fox, an owl, and a snake, that he is just about to meet up with a black-tongued, terrible-tusked, knobbly-kneed forest creature that's terribly hungry and is rather partial to, in turn, roasted fox, owl ice cream, and scrambled snake. Playfully illustrated by Axel Scheffler, it has sold more than 13.5 million copies, been translated into 107 languages, won several prizes for children's literature, and been turned into plays, theme park rides, and an Oscar-nominated 2009 animated short film. The idea, says Donaldson, was inspired by a traditional Chinese tale. It was only her second book. Having spent her formative years writing melodies and children's plays and busking around Europe, she didn't make her picture book debut until the age of 45, when someone suggested translating the rhyming prose of her song, A Squash and a Squeeze, into an illustrated book. The Gruffalo came along 6 years later in 1999, but it had been kicking around her head for a long time. Initially, the mouse was going to say to each predator, "I'm about to meet the Gruffalo," describe what it looks like, and they were immediately going to run away. Then one of my sons said, "Mum, why wouldn't they just eat the mouse before he ran?" She went back to the drawing board. It evolved as I was writing it, which is not common. I usually have the whole thing in my mind before I start. Once the book was finished, Donaldson sent the story to her publisher, who, much to her dismay, sat on it for a year. Growing impatient, she decided to send it to Scheffler, the illustrator behind her first book, on a whim. These days, his image of the hulking, horned and yellow-eyed Gruffalo is familiar to any child. But when Donaldson was dreaming him up, all ideas were welcome. "I had no vision whatsoever about what the Gruffalo would look like," she insists. "It was really just what rhymed with what. His tongue was black, and he had to have something on his back. What could he have on his back?" "Purple prickles," was the answer, after much deliberating. "Scheffler did a whole lot of sketches," remembers Donaldson. "He did one where the Gruffalo looked a little too much like a wild boar on all fours, one where he looked a bit too much like an ogre and a bit too human, and another where it was just right." The result immediately grabbed the attention of another publisher, Macmillan, and soon enough the Gruffalo was on shelves and delighting readers. "It got a tremendously glowing review," recalls Donaldson. "There was a picture of the Gruffalo saying it was a modern classic. That was my best moment." Its runaway success has made Donaldson and Scheffler the most successful author-illustrator partnership in the world. Entire bookshop sections are dedicated to their list of collaborations. On average, a Donaldson book is sold roughly every 11 seconds in the UK. She's written more than 100 books since The Gruffalo, and many of them, Room on the Broom, Stickman and Zog, to name a few, have been huge successes. Nothing, though, has been quite as popular as that woodland creature with terrible tusks, terrible claws and terrible teeth in his terrible jaws. "I vowed that I wouldn't be one of those grumpy authors like A.A. Milne who got sick of just being known for Winnie the Pooh," says Donaldson. "Its success," she adds, "probably helped my other books. It's a bit like a bouncy trampoline that I can jump my other books about on. But when people say to me, 'My favourite book is,' I wait and hope they're going to say one of the others," she laughs. "But I do love the Gruffalo, really. If they do pick one of the others, they have plenty to choose from." She had 3 books out last year alone. Dormouse Has a Cold, about a sniffling rodent in need of some cheering up. The Bower Bird, about an exotic bird called Bert, who builds elaborate nests in his search for love. And The Oak Tree, which follows a sturdy tree over 1,000 years. She has another out this summer, The Tooth Fairy and the Crocodile. Yet, being your child's favourite author hasn't become any easier. "I heard a costume designer on Desert Island Discs recently, and she was asked, 'How do you start?'" asks Donaldson. She said, "Every time I don't know how to do it, and I don't think I can do it. And it's the same with me. Each time I have to start afresh." But maybe that's what it is to be a creative. In a way, it's good to not quite know how you're going to go about it. It keeps it fresh. The rhyming is a particular challenge. "It's not easy to do," says Donaldson. "It's a lot of grind and sweat, and there are pages and pages of notes, alternatives and doodles. It's not quick at all." How does it feel, then, when she finally lands on that perfect couplet? It's very satisfying. It usually happens when I'm in the bath or out walking. Inspiration for story ideas, meanwhile, can strike at any time. She thought up the story of last year's The Bower Bird, which is illustrated by Catherine Rayner, when she was watching a David Attenborough documentary about the exotic birds. "They're so entertaining," she says. "They spend about 6 years learning how to make elaborate bowers and put all sorts of objects outside them. However, what really drew me in is that the programme showed one bird stealing another's treasures. It's nice to have a good villain. As with many of her books, Donaldson hopes to bring the tale to life through performance. It is at the book readings she does up and down the country where she really gets a sense of the impact of her work. It's very satisfying when parents say things like, "My child knows your story off by heart," she says. It makes me think back to my own childhood. I was given a poetry book by my father when I was 5, and that's how I knew I wanted to be a poet. Now I meet children, and they want to be writers too, and I think that's lovely, she smiles. I love to feel that I'm part of a chain of readers and writers. As for whether we've seen the last of the Gruffalo, she has toyed with some new ideas. So far, it's just toying, she insists. If I had a really good idea, I might, but no promises.
The Gruffalo, certainly one of the great children's stories. You'll recall in the last edition of Outlook a couple of weeks ago, Keith started telling us about Winston Churchill, the man, his inspirational leadership, but his idiosyncratic wardrobe and very unpredictable emotions. Keith now completes Churchill's story, written by Sinclair Mackay.
Anyone who encountered Churchill was taken aback by his ability to quote anything from comic characters to Greek classics to make his point. But way back in 1906, his friend Violet Asquith was amazed at dinner when she quoted one of Keats' poems and discovered that Churchill had never heard of the famous poet. What then about Blake? Churchill thought she was talking about an admiral. But the point about Churchill was that he was largely self-taught, everything from Shakespeare to the rise and fall of the Roman Empire. He told Asquith, a diarist and politician, "We're all worms, but I do believe I'm a glowworm." Years later, he could remember entire Shakespeare plays off by heart. The actor Richard Burton was playing Hamlet in the 1950s when Churchill came in from one performance, sitting near the front. Burton heard a curious rumbling noise and he realised that the Prime Minister was speaking the part of Hamlet along with him. Burton tried subtly to discourage him. "I went faster, I went slower, I went edgeways," he said. But the old man always caught up. After the performance, Burton was in his dressing room when there was a knock on the door and Churchill's head came peering round. The Prime Minister bowed, addressed Burton as "My good Lord Hamlet," and then asked to use his toilet. Burton had a gentler time than the music hall comedian Vic Oliver, who in the 1930s was married for a while to Churchill's daughter Sarah, much to the great man's distaste. Oliver was invited to Churchill's country home in Kent, Chartwell. Churchill introduced him to his black swans, Pluto and Persephone. There was another pet, too, that seemed eager to make Oliver's acquaintance. "Towards us, across the grass, trotted a friendly-looking goat," wrote Vic Oliver years later. "Mr. Churchill warned me to be careful of it. I patted the little beast on the nose and said with some bravado, 'Oh, he's all right. In fact, he likes me.' Mr. Churchill chuckled, 'Oh, yes, he's all right,' and said no more. We turned away and changed the subject. I had only walked a few yards when suddenly a mild tornado struck me in the seat of my pants. Churchill, laughing at the antics of his malevolent goat, repeated, 'Oh, yes, he's all right.' In fact, Churchill was intense in his adoration of his many animals, from his fat marmalade cats to swarms of goldfish to racehorses. He would personally feed the goldfish in their outdoor pools at Chartwell, summoning them with the cry, 'Hike, hike!' And in the later years, as a guest on board the luxury yacht Christina, owned by tycoon Aristotle Onassis, Churchill insisted upon taking an unusual extra passenger for cruises around the West Indies, his pet budgie, Toby. Churchill was also very physically unselfconscious. This was the case whether splashing about in the Mediterranean like a whale and losing his trunks, or talking in his Downing Street bedroom to a field marshal while clad only in white silk underwear that made him look like Humpty Dumpty, or, incredibly, in the aftermath of his 1953 stroke when he insisted to his doctors that he was fine. Churchill hopped bare-legged out of bed to prove to doctors Moran and Brain how fit he was. He was wandering around in his ridiculous little bed jacket and nightshirt, bare from the middle thigh downwards, recalled Dr. Brain. "You must see me walk," he said, and did a kind of goose step. He also declared his need for 2 steaming hot baths a day and made a prescription of sherry as refreshment for his doctors. His own medicine, a decanter of whiskey on the shelf by his bed, was ever present. Throughout his long and intensely full life, born in 1874 during Disraeli's premiership and dying in 1965 at the crest of the Rolling Stones fame, Churchill was courageous, impulsive, emotional, occasionally madly wrong, other times so right that he steered the course of history. But he was also, above all, profoundly human. There was no pretense about him, remembered his secretary, Lady Williams of Elwell. When he was mad, you knew it. When he was sad, he wept. When he was gay, he laughed like a child. In a word, he was all truth. Meeting Churchill, A Life in 90 Encounters by Sinclair Mackay, is out now. Viking Books, price £16.99. Visit expressbookshop.com or call 020-3176-3832. Free UK post and packing on orders over £25.
Churchill, complex character, not the most successful politician, but he was a superb wartime leader and, I suppose, the saviour of his country. In the news in the last Outlook, we reported that the Coventry Music Museum had won a major tourism award. So Dave's been back there to find out how they acquired the Ghost Town car.
Coventry Music Museum was founded by Pete Chambers and his wife, Julie, who talked about the piano owned by Hilda of Lieutenant Pigeon. And they all appeared on Top of the Pops in 1972, and they had a number one hit with Moldy Old Dough for 4 weeks. Right, I was speaking to Julie here. Right, and there's the piano actually used by the mum of Rob Woodward in Lieutenant Pigeon.
That's right, yes.
So where did you get the piano from?
We got it from her, well, from them when she died.
And that's the piano they played on Top of the Pops, which was recorded at Kingsway.
Yes, she played that for 25 years. She played it, bless her.
Yes.
And then she died, and her sons went to take it into their house. Yeah. And of course they couldn't, so they said, "Can we bring it to you?"
Okay.
So I said, "Yeah, that's lovely." And I'm very happy with it.
And as you walk into the Two-Tone Museum, on the right-hand side, there's a room where you can play musical instruments such as guitars, a keyboard, etc., and also the percussion instruments. And there's various guitars around this music room, and a keyboard, and tom-toms, and some percussion instruments. Okay, and we've been singing and playing Saturday Night at the Movies in the music room. John, Christopher and myself.
Saturday night at 8 o'clock, I know where I'm gonna go. I'm gonna pick my baby up and take her to the picture show. Every everybody in the neighborhood is dressing up to be there too. And we're gonna have a ball, just like we always do. Thank you very much. John and Christopher there. Thank you.
Kerry, I'm here in the music room downstairs where Christopher's been playing the guitar and we've been singing, is a theremin, which has got an aerial, and you waft your hand up and down it. You can hear that. I understand it's possible to get a tune out of it, but it's been done anyway. There you are. I then went upstairs to the main part of the museum, and there I met Nick, who was dressed as a two-tone girl, known as a rude girl. She was dressed in a Trilby hat, and she wore a black and white dress and a fur collar. I'm speaking to Nick. Can you describe how you dress, please?
So I'm dressed with my trilby, which is compulsory, of course.
Two-tone.
And I'm wearing mostly black and white, so I'm in my two-tone.
Yes. Yep. And a nice fur collar as well.
Yeah, yeah. A bit reminiscent. We've got Pauline's jacket that she used to wear back in the day around the corner.
That's Pauline Black.
Pauline Black from The Selector, yeah.
Yeah, yep. Fantastic. So what else have you got here?
Well, we have, each cabinet represents a different decade,
yeah.
So you've got a different focus.
That's right, yes.
We've got some special exhibitions like the Delia
Derbyshire. Delia, yeah.
She worked at the BBC Radiophonic Workshop.
Yes.
And, so you'll know her as the lady that brought the Doctor Who theme tune to life.
That's
back
it.
In the day.
That's right,
only
yes.
Recently got the credits for it.
Yeah.
But there we go, at least it's happening now,
yes.
Yeah.
Fantastic. Yeah. What else have you got? Apart from two-tone, then it's Frank Highfield, yes.
Yeah.
And he lived down round the corner to us until he was about nine.
Yeah.
Or even younger than that, maybe.
Yeah.
Yes.
And we have Lieutenant Pigeon.
Yes, yes.
We were celebrating their number one.
Yes.
2 years ago, so that was 50 years ago, that was number one in the chart.
Mouldy old
dough.
I used to help Christopher at Exhall Grange School, and here's John at Christmas Carers. So what do you think of the museum, John?
I'll tell you the truth, Dave. This museum is great,
mm-hmm.
And it's my third time to be here now.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
And I love it because, David, you know how to express everything about here. We understand it better because of you. And it's unfortunately, Christopher cannot go to the stairs to see the beauty of the upstairs.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
But it's unfortunately, you can't make it.
Right.
Okay, so what else you got here?
So on this particular wall, this is called our Wall of Hits.
Wall of Hits,
so these are all the singles that came from artists in Coventry and Warwickshire that made the top 10 in the charts.
Yes.
Ever since the charts began, back in the day, through to present day.
Wow.
And what we do every week is we ask our visitors to vote for their favourites.
Yeah.
And then on Sunday night, when we close for the week, we run the top 5 based on the most popular tracks. So that's last week's top 5.
Yes. That was number 1, Ghost Town the Specials. 2, This Town Coming Like a Ghost Town. And number 2, Will You, Hazel O'Connor. 3, Too Much Too Young, Special AKA. 5, Do Nothing, The Specials. And number 4, Crash, The Primitives. I ought to do this for a living.
Yeah. You're very good.
Thank you. Well, that's it. And we've got the mask used by Dave Willits, who has also come to the Monday Club. Well, here's the star attraction here, isn't it?
First town car, which you're very welcome to sit in.
Can you tell us about the car?
I'll tell you about the car. So the Music Museum's been open for 10 years now, which is brilliant. We celebrated our 10th birthday last year. And in the early days, somebody came up with the idea, why don't we get a Vauxhall Cresta, like the one used in the Ghost Town video, because then our visitors can sit in it, have their photo taken, like you've just been doing. So a couple of the guys from the Two-Tone Village, who know a thing or two about cars, went to some local scrapyards to see if they could get their hands on one, because it was a British-made car, it was a Vauxhall. But nothing locally at all, nothing at all in the scrapyards. So they reached out to, you know, the classic car clubs that they have. They reached out to some of those, say, where can we get our hands on one of these? And they got signposted to a scrapyard in North Wales. So they got in touch with them, and they said, yeah, sure, we've got four or five here, you're welcome to come down and take one, yeah, pick one. So they went down, and the true to form, there were four or five of these lined up in a row, varying degrees of decay, very rusty. So they just took the one on the end, because that was easiest to get out. We knew we didn't have a lot of space in the museum, so they cut the back off, left that in North Wales, and then bought all the front. There's no engine in it.
No.
There's no floor, as you can see. and then they brought it back, took it all apart piece by piece, and lovingly restored it, as you're seeing here today. And you know the little chassis identification number that you get on all vehicles? It's in the plaque just round the corner. They sent that off to the DVLA to see if there's a story behind the car, any provenance behind the car. And the DVLA wrote back to confirm the reg of the car, which meant the 28, I'll get the way around for my dyslexia, 24218RO, which meant that this was the actual car used in the video.
Fantastic!
And they went, oh, we chopped it in half! But it wasn't going to go anywhere without an engine anyway,
no,
was it?
That's right. Ghost Town was recorded at Woodbine Street Studios in Leamington Spa in April 1981.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that's fantastic. Okay, so how do you feel about sitting in the Ghost Town car?
Oh, I feel
John?
Excited.
Yeah.
Something that I wasn't even born that time, was I?
Yeah, no. Fantastic, isn't it?
It's fantastic.
Great stuff. Okay, thanks a lot, Nick, for showing us around.
You're welcome. Thank you very much for visiting. Hope to see you again.
Here's Christopher, who used to help with Exhall Grange Schools. So what do you think of the music museum? You enjoy it, playing
yeah.
the guitars?
Yeah.
And everything? Fantastic.
Yeah.
Here we are. We're outside now in the sunshine. That's all from Coventry Music Museum. It's goodbye from me, Dave Monks, and goodbye from
Chris
and John. Bye!
Bye!
I'm sure, as a mostly musical attraction and venue, the museum will make a fascinating visit, especially to people with a vision impairment. And Dave's visit to the museum brings us to the end of this week's programme. So, until next week, from the Outlook team and me, Nigel Hewin, it's goodbye for now.